BBC Radio 3, now live from the Royal College of Music, we have Proms Plus, presented this evening by Louise Fryer.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of Debussy's birth, and we're celebrating throughout the Proms season, starting tonight with a performance of Pelléas and Mélisande. French soprano Karen Vouch and Canadian baritone Philip Addis both make their debuts at tonight's prom, taking the title roles, and Sir John Eliot Gardner conducts this first ever period instrument performance at the proms with the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique and his Monteverdi Choir. The five-act opera is Debussy's only lyric drama for the stage. He completed it in 1902, basing it on a dramatic poem by Maeterlinck, who wrote a number of symbolist plays in the 1880s and 90s. He was regarded as something of a visionary, certainly in artistic circles. Fate and mysticism were his trademarks. And in choosing Pelléas et Mélisande, Debussy's aim was to create a timeless piece. This curious tale of a woman's innocent love for her husband's brother has been likened to the myth of Tristan and Isolde, where two young people are irresistibly attracted to each other. Debussy might not have liked that illusion. He admired Wagner, and in particular the opera Parsifal, but he apparently threw away page after page of his score for Pelléas because he said he could hear the ghost of Klingsor in them, by which he meant Wagner. For him, Wagner had put a full stop to the music of his time. So if Debussy's aim was to break new ground, he succeeded. And to explore the opera with me over the next 45 minutes, I'm going to be joined by Richard Langham Smith, a Debussy specialist who's research professor in music here at the Royal College and who's lifted a veil on Debussy in the Proms Guide, and Patrick McGuinness, professor of French and comparative literature at St Anne's College, Oxford. Among his many impressive achievements, including winning the Welsh Book of the Year just a couple of days ago, he's translated the collected poems of Stéphane Mallarmé, the symbolist whose poem inspired one of Debussy's most famous pieces, the Prelude à l'après-midi d'un faun. So please welcome my guests now. Dick, let me start with you, Dick. I wanted to know what makes this opera distinctive, if that was Debussy's aim.
Well, there's quite a few things, I think. He would have distanced it from Wagner, particularly, you've mentioned that name already, the W word. Debussy basically talked a lot of rubbish, composers do, but particularly about Wagner, because he said that Wagner's method with his leitmotifs and so on was awful because it was like handing somebody a picture and a card at the same time, you know. But then he goes and does that himself, because he published just before the opera, he published beautifully written out extracts, marked theme of Mélisande, theme of Pelléas, and so on. But there are some extra leitmotifs in it which you can't attach anything to. He's beginning to tempt you, to taunt you with the unknown, things that you can't fathom. So one of the things also is that it isn't really an opera. It has a story, but it's about things which are much deeper and more unfathomable than that.
So he takes his story from Maeterlinck. Patrick, the play is set in the imaginary kingdom of Allemande, ruled by the old king Arkel, who's nearly blind, and it doesn't really seem like the ideal setting of a work that's going to be groundbreaking and new. Why was he attracted to it?
Well, the first thing, I suppose, about Maeterlinck, which we have to remember, is that he was a pretty radical playwright. You know, he was the first modern playwright to really exploit things like silence and discontinuous character. He put his characters ill at ease in language, you know, Maeterlinck's characters, and this is something that Debussy replicates. You know, they're not at home in language, and they're not, in fact, at home anywhere. The whole point about Mélisande is no one knows where she comes from. She keeps saying, you know, I'm not from here, I'm from somewhere else. And I think that's the first thing that attracts people to Maeterlinck's dramatic world. He stages characters who really are placeless. You know, they're placeless within language and they're placeless in their own locations. And they're also dislocated from their own motivations, actually. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Pelléas and Mélisande is that it's basically a very traditional kind of love triangle melodrama, but it doesn't feel like it, because Maeterlinck has done something to that concept. He's kind of divorced action from motivation, feelings from behavior. It's an extraordinarily avant-garde way to think about dramatic character.
So he was a symbolist. What was the symbolist movement all about?
Well, the first thing about the symbolist movement is they chose the wrong word for themselves. They chose the wrong name because the whole point about what we think a symbol is that a symbol should be essentially understandable. We have a dove, which is the symbol of peace. The symbolists mean something that is basically exactly the opposite. The symbol for the symbolist is the space in the artwork, be it a piece of music or a poem or a painting, where you don't know what's going on and where the spectator, the reader, or the listener injects or projects their own, I suppose, view or their own ideas into this space. So it's exactly the opposite of symbolism, in fact. That's pretty evasive, but sadly it's true.
So why do you think Debussy wanted to tackle something that was so ambiguous?
Well, I think he liked things which were ambiguous, and he said, there's a very interesting quote that he said, that he was looking for a subject which would allow him the space to complete it, and that was certainly what he found in Pelléas and Mélisande. I think the symbolism thing, I mean, a symbol, I don't know if Patrick would agree, but a road narrows sign is a symbol in the way that we use it now?
Yes, that's right.
A sign, but it works in different levels for Debussy. It works on a literary level in the play. The most obvious one, I think, is the darkness and light thing, which goes all the way through in some way. They're always talking about darkness, they're always talking about light. But as Patrick says, you can't quite, if you try and pin that down in words, you've lost it.
Let's just hear it pinned down in words, shall we? I've got an extract from the original play. Here we have Patrick Brennan as Pelléas and Christine Absalom as Mélisande. And this is the first time they actually meet.
I can hear a noise somewhere below us. Ah, it's Pelléas. He hasn't seen us. Pelléas! Pelléas, is that you?
Yes. I came out to be by the sea.
So did we. We came here for the light. It's a little lighter here than elsewhere, and yet the sea is dark.
There's going to be a storm tonight. There's been one every night for some days now. Yet the sea is very calm tonight. You could put out to sea without knowing it. Never to return.
There's something putting out to sea.
It must be one of the tall ships. Her lights are very high up. We'll see her soon when she comes into the band of sunshine.
I'm not sure we'll be able to see her. There's still a mist hanging over the sea.
They say the mist will clear slowly.
Yes. I've just noticed a little light down there I hadn't noticed before.
It's a beacon. There are several others, but we can't see them yet.
So that's a scene from early on in the play and the opera. Why is light so important in the play, Patrick?
Well, Maeterlinck's own play, I think, makes a great deal out of oppositions between light and darkness. And one of the ways I would read that would be to do with what you know and what you don't know about character, about motivation, also about yourself. Maeterlinck's characters have almost no self-awareness. They can't finish their sentences. Often they don't hear each other properly. And when they're in fact talking about things like beacons and lights and ships far away, they're in fact talking about something else too. And Maeterlinck's whole way of constructing dialogue is to essentially delineate what he's trying to say by not saying it. People talk around the subject all the time in Maeterlinck, and they don't hear each other properly, and they misunderstand each other. And I suppose you read a play like that and you think, how could anyone construct a drama out of almost constant indirection, almost constant leaving out of what you mean and what you're trying to say? But then you remember that people like Beckett and Pinter built their entire dramatic oeuvres around exactly that way of thinking about the relationship between character and language. So I suppose there is an explanation. It's just that in the 1890s, when Maeterlinck was writing, people simply didn't know what he was doing. They didn't know where he came from. In that sense, he's a bit like Mélisande.
So he particularly attracted an artistic audience rather than trying to appeal to the general public?
Yes, I think that's right. And Richard's point about the unfinishedness of the play, I mean, one of the things that Debussy found attractive about the play was that he thought that it was unfinished. And He actually says in the letter that he'd been looking for a specific play that he could set to music, one specific play, and he hadn't found it until he came across Maeterlinck, because what Maeterlinck had done was present him with a play that was unfinished. And I love this idea of Debussy finishing the play, the idea that the play is incomplete and needs something else to supplement it. And that's a very good definition, actually, of symbolist art and poetry as well. It is an incomplete work which you, as readers, spectators, listeners, and in the case of Debussy, interpreters, come along and finish.
Dick, do we know much about the first production that Debussy went to see?
Very difficult, but I think it's one of the most crucial questions. Did he really fall for the play because he read it, or did he fall for it because of this rather strange production done once only in the afternoon in a little theatre in Paris by the producer and actor Lunier Poe, who had a very advanced théâtre de l'œuvre, a company which produced symbolist plays in a very strange way. Now, this play actually came to London, where the critics wrote very much more about it than they did in France. There was a particular critic called Virginia Crawford who wrote about horses, Catholicism, and French literature. And she saw this play and thought it had the most wonderful spiritual depth, because most of it was dark. In between the audience and the play was a torn green gauze curtain, and the players actually spoke almost as if their voices were dismembered, not in a real sort of way. Now, other critics didn't like it at all. In fact, one of them said it was like a coal mine. And another one, much more to the point, said, what happened? You went to the theatre and you saw a pre-Raphaelite curtain, and the curtain opened and you saw a pre-Raphaelite tapestry, and the tapestry opened and you saw a pre-Raphaelite wood. And of course, this is actually, Maeterlinck was crazy about the English painter Burne Jones, where you have these angel figures and knights that you couldn't tell exactly when they're set, but these figures, this medieval land of knights and damosels, is very much at the heart of Pelléas and Mélisande.
And did Debussy approach Maeterlinck pretty much straight away?
Yes, he got permission, but then there was a big row, because Maeterlinck wanted his, at that time, companion, Georgette Leblanc, who sang a jolly good Carmen, but wouldn't have been much of a Mélisande, and they fell out about that. But later, Maeterlinck revised his opinion, and also, although he fell asleep during the first performance he heard of Pelléas, he wasn't really musical, he admitted that Debussy had really completed and immortalised his play.
And do we know much about how the two men got on, Patrick? Did they enjoy each other's company, or did they try and avoid each other as much as possible?
Well, they were very different people. I mean, Maeterlinck might have written quite spiritual, poetic work, but he was quite a fleshy person. You know, he liked drinking and eating and boxing.
Yeah,
and you know, he was a man of the flesh, essentially, or even though he wrote poems and plays that were very kind of ethereal. And I think people were very surprised, and some of them disappointed, and some of them pleasantly surprised when they discovered that he wasn't like that at all in real life. And one of the things that he did, in fact, was threaten to challenge Debussy to a duel, because he pretended that they had what artists call artistic differences, but it was simply because Debussy wouldn't use his mistress to play Pelisande. Mélisande. That would be the sequel.
That would be the androgynous character, wouldn't it?
I'm sure there was one of those too. But but at the end, I mean, he did see that Debussy had given his play another lease of life, and he does say, you know, Pelléas and Mélisande will always belong to you. So he was capable of some grace as well by the end. I think the other thing about Maeterlinck's plays is that he didn't always deal in this kind of mock 1890s medievalism. You know, he'd written some really quite radical one-act plays in which very radically nothing happens, which he had called static theatre. You know, Maeterlinck had pioneered static theatre. He said, I want to create a theatre where nothing happens, where the only dialogue is essentially non-instrumental dialogue, so people say how they're feeling, but always by avoiding talking about how they're feeling. And the avant-garde audience loved this, but the normal public, assuming such a thing existed, didn't. You know, they didn't like it. People found Maeterlinck's plays offensive and frightening. And we also have to remember that this was, in cultural terms, a very sort of turbulent period in France. You know, you had bank collapses, a bit like now, actually, bank collapses, terrorist activities, there were bombs going on all over Paris. So actually the theatre was one of the few places you could go to be able to rely on nothing happening. You could actually get some peace in the theatre.
So a play where nothing happens, but also some of Debussy's fellow composers felt that this was music without music.
Well, music without singing was the usual quip about it. And people wonder where that came from. Of course, partly it does come from the way that he really did understand Maeterlinck's characterization through the speech, because Golo speaks in a very different way from the other characters. Pelléas has got a lyrical quality to what he says. Mélisande says things which are just, you don't know what she's on about. And she has questions. You ask Mélisande, where do you come from? And she says, I feel cold. That type of oblique answer. She's characterized by what we don't know about her rather than by what we do. But the other thing is, where does this style come from? People go on about, oh, he got it from Monteverdi or from Baroque opera. I don't think that's true at all. I think he got it because his own songs in the 1890s were evolving in that direction. His Fêtes Galantes, settings of Verlaine, have a lot of this sort of speech stuff in them. Take Fauré's setting of the similar poems, there's a lovely tune. But it doesn't penetrate the local meaning of the words in the same way. So I think he developed it really out of his own trajectory towards a sort of more speech way of singing. But he can occasionally sort of stretch out more towards aria. Where did you come from? I've come away, I've come away, I've come away. And she sings things three times maybe. And that is this tendency towards lyricism. Then the love scene, the most lyrical thing perhaps in that is the orchestra. He called the orchestral background le décor orchestral. Everything happens in the background and a lot happens in the beautiful interludes in between the acts.
Well, that brings us very nicely to an extract of the music. In Act 3, Golo takes Pelléas to the dungeon where there's a stagnant pool, and the next scene begins with Pelléas gasping for breath as they re-emerge into the light. And this is the music that Debussy wrote to mark that transition from darkness to light. Wolfgang Holzmeier as Pelléas, finally able to breathe again. It's such a remarkable passage of music, isn't it? You can almost hear those lungs filling.
Well, the landscape music, I mean, everybody calls Debussy an impressionist, but it is landscape music, but it's really of a different sort, I think. And he's got two ways in which he can portray dark and light. He's got the sounds of the instruments, the orchestration, literally low sounds for the dark and higher sounds for the light, but he's also got key. And he uses the sharp keys, the C-sharp major, for this business of moving into the light. And it's very significant that he interprets Mélisande's death in this way, that what she's actually done is she has, in the end, attained the sharpest key. She dies in a radiant light. She doesn't die in a paroxysm or a convulsion like Mimi and so many other operatic deaths. She dies in this radiance. And that's something I think he might impose on the opera. On the play. I mean, he's a sort of producer of the play in his own way, and he does it partly by cutting phrases and cutting whole scenes in one or two cases. But for me, the way that he characterizes Mélisande as somebody who dies at the end because she's lost the only thing that was valuable, love, and also the way he characterizes her at the beginning as quite an allumeuse, quite a turn on to Pelias. You know, Pelias is always running away. And she said, oh, Pelias, why are you going? Very slowly and with beautiful chords. You could have that as a throwaway line.
I'm interested in, well, obviously there's a very strong sexual content. He was writing it around the time that Freud was beginning to explore dream worlds and the subconscious. Are there many overlaps, do you think, Patrick?
There are certainly some overlaps. Freud did train in Paris in the late 80s, early 1890s. But one of the things that we have to be careful about when we use the term unconscious is that we have to realize that it was being bandied about by a lot of people to mean essentially the subconscious, and there is a difference between the two things. And Maeterlinck does use unconscious, inconscient, and subconscious, subconscient interchangeably, so he's got no Freudian sense of what it means. But of course he is producing work that completely lays itself open to Freudian and also Jungian interpretation. So yes, I mean, certainly those scenes where they go down to the caves where the smell of death is rising up and so on, that's absolutely susceptible to that kind of interpretation. And Maeterlinck would have known what he was doing, but he wouldn't have needed Freud to tell him, as it were.
Didn't he write himself a book called The Psychology of Dreams?
That was a title that was imposed by one of the editors on Maeterlinck's essays about dreams. But yes, he was fascinated by dreams, and lots of the decor of Pelléas et Mélisande is dreamscape. Maeterlinck uses one of the things he does, which is very rare for a symbolist playwright, because the symbolists were so refined that they suspected theatre of being essentially a kind of botched genre. They thought that only poetry and possibly music were the perfect genres, and they thought theatre was dirty and messy, which is why, as Richard said, you have all these gauzes and these tapestries and disembodied voices. Maeterlinck wasn't like that. He liked getting stuck into decor. He liked watching the decor being made. He was very particular and detailed about what the decor represented. His stage directions are enormous by comparison with his contemporaries. And he is absolutely determined to make decor and setting into a kind of correlative for the feelings and sensations of his characters. In fact, the decor knows more about what the characters feel than the characters themselves.
Yeah, that's funny, because Debussy said a similar thing about that what he was interested in is the mysterious correspondences between nature and the imagination.
Yeah.
It's never just a picture. It's about something within us, as it were. The storm out to sea, the beacons, everything, the forest.
But that's why I think Debussy was one of the few composers who really understood symbolism, and that's why he was so good with not just Maeterlinck, but Mallarmé and Verlaine as well, because he realized that fundamentally with symbolist art, something always means something else. So you have to keep your consciousness moving towards the next thing. It's never still, that's the point. That's why his music is best placed to represent it, I think.
And yet there's a wonderful continuity of memory. Things come back again and again, don't they, musically?
The piece is very circular, and of course the motives do that for you. There is the one motive that occurs when when Golo first announces that he is the king of Allemande, and that motive comes out on a trumpet at the end of the first interlude. That's really something to hear. But it also comes at the end when he says, well, what is the soul? And you hear do 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 do, very strange. You can't pin that motive down to anything.
I'm interested in the character of Mélisande. I mean, how far is she related to the idea of Melusine, of Rusalka, of these kind of watery nymphs? She seems terribly otherworldly in many ways.
I don't think she's a nymph. Not really. I think she's a distant princess, somebody who has suffered something terrible. The word is she suffered une grande épouvante, I think. Mm. She suffered a great dreadful. And this dreadful
thing...
So very
thing, specific, then.
Yeah, something awful. And it is no doubt Bluebeard who has abused her in the past. And she's come into this world, and first she'd rather die than have Golo touch her. She's an abuse victim in that way. She can't stand a man to touch her. And in the end, he does abuse her. And then the terrible line at the end of the opera, where the little child is born, now it's the turn of the pauvre petite. You know, the whole cycle is going to go again. So that's the dark side of the opera, maybe.
Let's hear another musical extract. This is from the beginning of Act 3, and Melisande is at her window. Not quite so innocent here, possibly. She's combing her long hair as Pelias appears below. He says he's going, he wants to kiss her, ends up kissing her hair instead. Let's just hear how Debussy sets that up. Such an innocent vocal line, isn't it?
Yeah, but she's not innocent, by no means. At the end of it, I mean, I've already mentioned that bit about, well, Pelias is going away and she gives him the green light, but she plays with her wedding ring above the well, and in the final act, Pelias asks her, he says, are you really telling me the truth? And she said, oh, yes, I only lie to your brother. You know, she is not innocent. She may look it, and that's one of the deceptions.
What's the obsession with hair, Patrick?
Well, it's certainly a pre-Raphaelite thing, but there's also... I think there's also the obsession with Ophelia. Ophelia was a hugely important symbolic figure for the French writers of the late 19th century because Ophelia was feminine, she was dead, and there was a lot of water involved. And, you know, those are three sort of big recommendations for French fantasy culture. And she, you know, and so Mélisande is a kind of French stroke Belgian cousin of Ophelia.
Let's listen to the extract from the play now after that opening that we've just heard.
Hola! Hola!
Who's there?
It's me. It's me. What are you doing at the window, singing like some bird from far away?
I'm letting down my hair, ready for the night.
Is that what I can see against the wall? I thought you had a light with you.
I opened the window. It was too hot in the tower. It's such a beautiful night.
Yes, there are thousands of stars. I've never seen so many. But the moon's still over the sea. Don't stay there in the shadows. Mélisande. Lean out a little so I can see your hair falling loose.
I look dreadful like this.
Oh, Mélisande. Oh, you are so beautiful, beautiful like that. Lean out, lean out. Let me come a little closer to you.
I can't come any closer. I'm leaning out as far as I can.
I can't climb up any higher. Let me at least hold your hand tonight before I go away. I'm leaving tomorrow.
So innocent or not so innocent?
Not so innocent, I think. Milad.
Well, the opera does sort of de-innocent her because if you read the play and if you see the play, her motivations are kept incredibly sort of unclear, whereas I do think that the interpretation that Debussy gives it makes her more knowing, I think. And that's partly because the music kind of fills her out. But if you are just listening to her, and remember as well that in Maeterlinck's day, the Lugny Po production would have had the characters speaking almost like puppets with voices. You know, Maeterlinck sought out a real kind of monotone way of speaking because he didn't want things like the actors' bodies and the actors' voices to intrude upon the voice and upon the words. It was all about having a kind of phobia of material representation, and that included voice.
He would have liked radio, really, wouldn't he? It would have been the perfect medium for him.
Yes, almost certainly, actually, yes. Divorcing language from substance is what Maeterlinck was really after.
I mean, I still find that text when he's talking about drowning in her hair and wanting to kiss it and touch it, that's pretty sexy. I don't think that's very deep.
It's not very depersonalized. But that's the point, isn't it? It is very sexual. It's very erotic. But the whole question is whether the characters have really got any say in what they're doing. This is the point. They don't have enough self-awareness. They are kind of conduits for emotions that come from and lead far beyond them. And that's what Maeterlinck does, which I think is very, very unusual.
It seems to me that Arkell is a character who is very much involved in what you're saying, because, again, I find that Debussy perhaps interprets him for you, in the sense that Arkell Boulez once described as a grey-haired Pelias, meaning even though he's about 106 and blind, he doesn't understand any more about life at that age than Pelias, the young boy, understands. And Debussy rather cuts quite a few phrases out of him and makes him much more of a wise man. And his gospel is we can never see the underside of fate. We can never see even the underside of our own fate. So why should we do anything? We must be passive and accept what fate has given to us. And I think it's interesting that fate he doesn't see in the opera. It's not God who is the controller of the marionettes. Yeah. God is only mentioned very slightly at the end. It seems to be the idea of the blind man, in a sense, that I think Schopenhauer saw man as a blind man on the shoulders of an ape. Mm. There's that sort of idea that it's the naked ape that we all thought was new in 1965 or something, but it was going on then, perhaps.
There's a very strong theme of blindness, isn't there, that runs through the piece. I mean, they meet at the Fountain of the Blind, and Arkell is half blind, and Gollo at the end says that he is going to end up as a blind man because he never really knows whether Melisande was unfaithful.
But maybe Patrick would agree that there is a sense in which the blind man is actually the one who sees most.
Yeah, I mean, Maeterlinck's characters are blind, but he wants them to be blind. He wrote a whole play called The Blind, which, as you might deduce, is about blind people. But they're blind people who have lots of supplementary senses and sensations, and they're only blind in a literal sense. And what's going on here, I think, is that the characters don't have, well, Melisande, certainly Pelias, they don't have sufficient self-awareness to know what they're doing, but it's as if they're actors and the roles are themselves. You know, there's always a distance in Maeterlinck between the character and their role, between themselves and their motivations. So at some level, they're always blind, but it doesn't prevent them from doing and saying things that might help us to see things or to deduce things.
Do you think we're supposed to learn a lesson from the play?
No. No, I think categorically not, really. What we are supposed to learn is how to evoke and feel without necessarily needing to put everything into words, how to know things without rationally understanding them.
Now, Debussy is a master of that, isn't he?
Absolutely.
In the music.
I think so. Well, music in its own way is the expression of the profound without the intervention of words. Yeah. And that's why, to me, the interludes are just so wonderful in the opera. But I'm not quite sure. No, we don't learn a lesson from it, but it provokes us, the story and the music, in very different ways. I mean, I think this whole idea of fate and predestination and all that is a big theme. And that's why Allemande, he calls it in this phrase, which is a mixture of the two languages of Belgium, Flemish and French. And it says straight at the beginning, this opera might be about Pelias and Melisande, but no, it's actually about you and me. It's about everybody. This is a universal thing. And if you take away all the trappings of a particular setting, you imagine Zola, for example, where if a train goes by, Zola will tell you how many wheels it's got and how many rivets at the end of the carriages. And for Maeterlinck, it is exactly the opposite. The more you strip away contemporaneity, the more you get to the depths of what he calls the soul.
But it's interesting that Debussy wanted the ambiguity, and yet at the same time, as you were saying earlier, he absolutely controls how we should feel at each moment by the way he orchestrates.
I don't think he controls how we feel at each moment, but I think sometimes the music tells us a bit, but there's still plenty of holes, plenty of space for us to make our interpretation.
Well, let's hear a little bit more. This is where Golo has sent Melisande off to look for the ring that she has dropped in the fountain at her meeting with Pelias, but she claims she's lost it on the beach, and he bizarrely sends Pelias along with her.
Did you hear Nuage there from the Nocturnes? It's the same music as the clouds come over the sky. And what a wonderful evocation of a sea cave that music is. But the sea is, you hear its rhythm, but it is also so threatening and dark. And the sea's moods, I live by the sea and I look out every morning and I think, yes, you know, she's nice today, she's going to be kind. And another day, like a cauldron.
I'm interested to know what Debussy took from this opera and kind of ran with, if you like, in his later work.
He wasn't somebody who liked to repeat formulas. He didn't want to do the same thing again ever. He was very interested all his life in setting an opera on the works of Edgar Allan Poe, and now that comes out in the dark side of this piece. But he never could complete it, and he kept fiddling with it and altering it. It's now been put together, which gives you a very good insight into a different part of his personality. But he could never repeat Pelias. He never really wrote another opera.
He spent a long time working on this one, didn't he?
Yes, he started with the love scene. He didn't start at the beginning. He started somewhere in the middle, and it sort of grew around it and fiddled with it. He fiddled with it up to his dying day, little bits of orchestration, little bits of harmony.
And how did it go down with the public?
Well, there was a mixture. I mean, many people realised that it was just the most incredible, new, sensitive thing that had come out. Quite a lot of literary people, more than musical people. A lot of jealousy around from the various chapelles in Paris, you know, people who, Dandy and him, didn't really get on very well. Ravel, as I think I said, went to every single performance. Ravel was totally overcome. And now it's become one of the most performed French operas. I think it must be second to Carmen.
And what about the performance that we're going to hear tonight at the Proms? It's being done by a period instrument orchestra. Is that going to change our interpretation or understanding of the opera?
Let's see. I mean, it's lovely to have a concert performance, because it's like the radio versus television. The pictures are better on the radio. And we don't have to put up with Melisande swinging from lampshades or Arkell having a drip, all this kind of stuff that you do get, or I could go on, it's a hobby horse. But for me, the vital link between what you see of the landscape and what Debussy does to that landscape, that should be untouchable. That can't be broken. So there's a fashion for Pelias performances to be done in drawing rooms, Edwardian, enclosed drawing rooms and so on. I just think I can't take that if Melisande's having, you know, chips and mayonnaise instead of actually walking on the cliffs. It's something which for me is sacred.
Well, when you're watching in the hall, there will be a little bit of stage movement, but John Elliott Gardner particularly wanted it to be a concert production, a concert performance that he's kind of elevated rather than an opera performance that he's reduced to fit on the Royal Albert Hall stage. I'm interested in other composers that were also drawn to Pelléas and Mélisande. And their different interpretations. Who else had a go at it?
Oh, Schönberg, Fauré, is that all? Maybe Sibelius, I think.
Yeah, I think Sibelius wrote some incidental music.
Fauré's music is very decorative and pretty, which was another way that the piece was staged in London, by with plenty of decor and sort of spinning wheels and prettiness, and in drag, actually. Pelléas was played by a woman.
And Maeterlinck is still performed today?
Yeah, he's performed mainly for these very intense one-act static plays that he wrote, which were also known as the Theatre of Death, which were incredibly concentrated, frightening plays that had people running out of the theatre in terror. And those are still performed, mainly because they're incredibly radical pieces of non-happening drama. And we think of them as really prefiguring, as I said, Beckett and Pinter. But certainly Pelléas, I think, does owe its existence to what Debussy made of it. I think Maeterlinck realized that immediately, as soon as he heard the music, he realized that this play, at least, and possibly his own reputation, would survive through Debussy. What is interesting is that lots of writers and dramatists and filmmakers wanted, after Debussy had turned this into an opera, to re-liberate Maeterlinck's play from Debussy's music. Jean Cocteau had a project to make a film where he writes to Maeterlinck and says, you know, the opera is all very well, but your words have become trapped again. So, you know, on the one hand, we think of Debussy as liberating Maeterlinck, you know, rather as you'd uncork a bottle and let the aroma come out. But for Cocteau, what Debussy had done was actually clamp it back down into the kind of definition that the play was never designed to have. So he wanted to free it.
Now, of that clamped down version, Dick, which bit are you most looking forward to this evening?
Oh, I love that bit which we heard the extract of, where nothing happens and they just talk about the weather. That's just wonderful.
It's very English, isn't it?
That's what I like. Yeah, very English. But also, we shouldn't forget that Maeterlinck was also a very popular essayist. And this little book, which I found in a second-hand bookshop, The Treasure of the Humble, is a book which is almost like a key to understanding Pelléas and Mélisande. It's a collection of essays which he wrote before Pelléas and possibly during, and then he collected them together and reordered them in a volume. But it's interesting, this is third and fourth editions in English. So he was somebody who was read. Somebody said that he was read by philosophers who had lost their faith. But they're fascinating as a clue to his ideas. And one of the things I draw out for it, however dark the opera is, there is a strong idea in the redemptive power of a certain kind of love. And he orders it so that the last essay in it has this repeated phrase, aimer ainsi, to love in this way. And this brings purity and understanding that nothing else can. And that is my interpretation of this. The opera is pessimistic, but there is also this idea that Mélisande, she dies beautifully and quietly and silently, and she goes up to heaven because she knows of this love.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank my guests, Richard Langham-Smith and Patrick McGuinness. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll all here enjoy the opera. It starts at 7 o'clock. Thank you.
Proms Plus from the Royal College of Music was presented by Louise Fryer. The producer was Helen Garrison. And Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande begins at 7 o'clock this evening.
The Olympic Games are coming back to London.
From Friday the 27th of July.
It is the one we've been waiting for.
The BBC is bringing every event.
It is now a time to shine.
From every venue.
This is pressure on now. It's a great buzz around the stadium.
to everyone in the UK.
Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, scream and shout!
The Olympic Games. Never miss a moment. With the BBC.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's time now for Words and Music. And the subject on this St Swithin's Day is rain. The readers are Tim McMullen and Emily Taffer, and during the programme you'll hear poems by Thomas Hardy and Don Patterson, and music by Chopin, Sibelius and Debussy. And we begin with Liszt's Nuages Gris.
I bring fresh showers for the thirsting flowers, from the seas and the streams. I bear light shade for the leaves when laid in their noonday dreams. For my wings are shaken the dews that waken the sweet buds every one, when rocked to rest on their mother's breast as she dances about the sun. I wield the flail of the lashing hail and whiten the green plains under, and then again I dissolve it in rain and laugh as I pass in thunder. I am the daughter of earth and water and the nursling of the sky. I pass through the pores of the ocean and shores. I change, but I cannot die. For after the rain, when with never a stain, the pavilion of heaven is bare. And the winds and sunbeams with their convex gleams build up the blue dome of air. I silently laugh at my own cenotaph, and out of the caverns of rain, like a child from the womb, like a ghost from the tomb, I arise and unbuild it again.
Thank you. Words for Clouds. Alto cumulus, alto stratus, cirro cumulus, cirro stratus, cirrus, cumulonimbus, cumulus, nimbo stratus, strato cumulus, stratus, calvus, capillatus, castellanus, congestus, vibratus, floccus, fractus, humulus, lenticularis, nebulosis, spissatus, stratoformis, uncinus, duplicatus, intortus, lacunosus, pellucidus, radiatus, translucidus, undulatus, pannus, pileus, vellum. 22-degree halo, anti-crepuscular rays, circumzenithal arc, cloud bow, corona, crepuscular rays, glory, iridescence, rainbow, sun, moon, pillar, sun dogs, arcus, incus, mama, tuba, virga, cap, banner, cloud, contrail, diamond dust, distrail, fall streak hole, fog, horseshoe vortex cloud, Kelvin Helmholtz cloud, nacreous, noctilucent, pyrocumulus, roll cloud. The thunder mutters loud.